This interview is with Mr. Claude W. Miller of Jardington, Texas. Mr. Miller is 52 years old and was raised in Jardington. The Miller family and relatives have been in South Texas since the 1820s. Mr. Miller is an heir to the Odin Ranch with his ancestors established in the early 1820s. Mr. Miller is also my father-in-law.
My name is Claude W. Miller. I was born in Atascosa County on July 19, 1922. My ancestors had been in this area since the 1820s. Two of my grandfathers, very prominent in the area, one of them, Mr. A.G. Martin, was the founder, one of the founders of the city of Pleasant. Another one, Mr. T.W. Odin, established one of the largest ranches ever assembled in this area. His untimely death in 1905, he was the father of six young children, which I was born to his youngest daughter, Mary Odin. My father's name was Bobby Miller. He arrived here in 1912. His mother, Elizabeth Jane Scott Miller, came from the Carolinas, and ironically, her husband, or my other grandfather, William Miller, died also in the year 1905. And my grandmother Miller, coming from the Carolinas, could remember a lot of the experiences. She was born July 19, 1857. She could remember President Lincoln. Great grandmother Miller was an unusual character in her own way. She didn't have a formal education, naturally. But she had a lot of experiences that most of us don't get to see today. Like I said, she could remember seeing President Lincoln in one of his campaigns, since she comes from that region of the country. But she later migrated further south, and then a year after she was married with her family, and her husband's two brothers and their families migrated by wagon train to the state of New Mexico, then back to Oklahoma, and then down to this region. And during this time, she had many experiences where they had contact with the Indians, and they fought off the Indians several times with the usual method by putting the wagons on the outside and the women and children on the inside, and eventually those that survived could go on. And one of the tricks she often described that the Indians would play on when they were in the prairies of either West Texas or New Mexico, that the Indians would catch the north wind or the south wind blowing and set the grass afire. Only defense they had for this is to set the grass afire where they were, so it would be cooled off before the fire of the engine set could reach them. This is the only safety they had. And she also talked quite a bit about the wolves in New Mexico would attack the cattle, and the cattle would form a circle and put the calves in the center. And eventually they would either lose the calves or run the wolves off. But this was the only defense that the cattle had for this type of attack. I've never witnessed anything like that in this area, but I've heard about it from other sources. But one of the reasons I wanted to mention my grandmother Miller, she was I considered her a worldly wise person. And she made a couple of remarks that I think were outstanding, since she could remember a lot. And in later days, after I was grown, or almost grown, able to drive and take the places where she wanted to go, I was the favorite one that she wanted to take her any place, because I drove faster than anybody else. And she was in a hurry to get there. And she was quite a religious person. And she talked quite a bit about what the preachers used to have to say. And what struck me the most was when they first started talking about automobiles right after the turn of the century. In the 1900s, the ministers attacked this violently and called it the work of the devil or Satan or whatever. They said that God made man and God made horses. He made horses for men to ride. They always rode them and they always would. But the automobile is kind of a passion thing. And then later on, she said that they started talking about men flying. And of course, she had moved about quite a bit in her life, and she was in different areas when this time came along. But the minister still had about the same attitude toward flying that they did the automobile. They said that if God intended for men to fly, they'd give them wings. And the remark that she made that tickled me the most was, she said, "You know what I did the first time I saw an airplane? I hid in the garage to watch it so the neighbors wouldn't see me." Well, you can see what she was trying to say, that automobiles were all right, but she still couldn't be seen watching the airplane, and yet she could ride with her sons in their automobiles. And that's the way life seems to be. As we progress, we accept changes as we go along. I've seen quite a few changes in my 52 years, and hope that I'll see some, probably will see greater changes in the future. Now, the person I'd like to go back to is one of the first persons that I can remember. And his name is Robert Bob Lauderdale. He was a trail driver of the Chisholm Trail I'm speaking of here. He was one of the first trail drivers, as I understand it, and went up the trail many times. I don't remember exactly how long the Chisholm Trail existed. I think that drive lasted for a span of about 12 years. Some of the larger herds were assembled in this area on the Laparita. And Bob Lauderdale was the trail boss and took these herds up the trail. He wrote a book in 1936 along with a man by the name of John Dope. The title of the book is Life on the Range by John Dope and Life on the Trail by Bob Lauderdale. This man lived until about World War II, and he, in his later years, as far back as I can remember, he liked to stay on the ranch with my mother's four brothers. And I was probably 10, maybe 12 years old before I fully understood that I wasn't related to him, that he wasn't a relative. And what caused me to believe this, everybody referred to him as Uncle Bob, and naturally being a young child, I thought he really was my uncle, which he was. He seemed to take a fancy to me, and I can remember him holding me on one knee and talking to him when I was very young. But later on, what I want to talk about, I've listened to him gone to sleep many a time, listened to him tell about his experiences on the trail. One thing I remember that one remark he made, that when he would be out on the trail and he'd be responsible for these large herds that they drove, that he would, if he went in one direction, the danger would be Indians, in the other direction it would be buffalo. Equally, it would be either one of them could spell disaster for the entire operation. And he'd say, "I'll give my horse just to know which way to go." And you stop and think about it, because in that day and time, that was probably his most prized possession, was his horse, which he had plenty of. But still, a horse was one of his most important possessions, along with his gun and water. Food was no problem under those conditions, since they had plenty of beef with them. So, I'll just go ahead and tell us some of the things that he told about. In 1877, Lauderdale and my grandfather's brother, Volley Odin, drove a trail, a herd of cattle up to Dodge City. And while they were there, the Indians had been on an uprising, and the government had made a treaty with them. This was soon after General Custer had made his last stand with the Little Bighorn. These were the same Indians that had wiped him out, and they were led by Chief Sitting Bull. In the year 1877, Lauderdale and Volley Odin, which was my great uncle, went into Dodge City, and the Indians were there. They did a war dance in the streets of Dodge City. And later on, Lauderdale and Odin went and called on Chief Sitting Bull personally and shook hands with him. Another member of the cowboys that was with him, he didn't want any part of this. Uncle Bobby used to laugh about that he didn't want any part of shaking hands with this Indian Chief Sitting Bull. And the next year, Uncle Bob tells about when he was going up the trail, he met some of the same Indians, and they left the reservation, and they were out on the warpath. And they came up to him, and they were, some of them remembered him. And so he gave them four fat steers that they could take with them, and they let him go on unharmed. And he was allowed to pass unharmed, and the next day, Max Stewart, which had a herd further south, came across the same Indians, and Stewart refused to give the Indians any beef, so they rode into his herd and shot 18 of the best steers that he had, and then allowed him to go on. Later, the same Indians stampeded trail boss by the name of Rainey. They stampeded the entire herd because he refused to give them any beef. And they lost all the cattle, and all the cowboys had to ride into Dodge for safety. Well, what was outstanding about this was that this man Rainey was riding a horse that Lauderdale had broke and trained here in the city of Pleasant. And the horse had been shot through the muscles in the forequarters, but yet he carried his rider on safety if Dodge City could get away from the Indians. At this time, I'd like to talk a little bit about Volley Odin, which is my great uncle. He was given credit for being the youngest trail boss that ever take a herd of cattle up the Chisholm Trail. And I can't say for certain that this was a fact, because I'm sure accurate records wasn't kept things like this back in the 1880s, 70s and 80s rather. But at least Lauderdale gave me credit for this, because he told me so personally when I was about 15 years old. And it's easy to see how he might be correct, because Bobby Odom was killed by Indians when he was 22 years old. But he took a herd of cattle belonging to George F. Hines and his stepfather, Pat Murphy, consisted of a herd of 10,000 head in the year 1879. Bobby Odom took this herd to Dodge City and sold them to a man by the name of M. Half. I think M. Half was a cattle buyer that bought a lot of the cattle that were assembled and moved up the trail from this area. This herd of cattle that Volley Odom took up there, the brand, was called Turkey Track 5. This brand was later claimed by T.W. Odom, which was my grandfather, and he branded all his cattle with Turkey Track 5. Later on, after his death, well, his oldest son, Wilton Odom, kept the brand registered and used the brand Turkey Track 5. And now that same brand is, my brother has it registered here at the courthouse in Jordan, and his cattle is branded with that same brand, Turkey Track 5. The brand is over 100 years old, and I don't know whether that's worthy information, but that brand's been around quite a while, as you can see, Reed. And Pleasant, in the city of Pleasant, claims that they are the birthplace of the cowboy. Each year they have a celebration where they have parades and fiddle contests and everything that goes with small town celebration. And it's called the Cowboy Homecoming. Each year they select the cowboy of the year, and some cowboy of the past is nominated to the Cowboy Hall of Fame. I've been asked by some of the leaders in the community to get all the information I can on Volley Odom, and also my grandfather, T.W. Odom, that they're eligible candidates and should be nominated for this Cowboy Hall of Fame. And one of the more humorous things I get, guess I've been around here a long time, when strangers come in and ask questions, several times they've referred them to me because they know that I've been here a long time and can remember a lot from stories that have been handed down. One fellow asked me what claim did Pleasant or Escosa County have on the birthplace of a cowboy. And I told him, well, that I was sure of one thing, that I believe they had as much claim to it as anybody else, and the reason they had a right to it, they thought of it first. So, anyway, that Pleasant is giving credit for the birthplace of the cowboy, so I think they have about as much right to it as anybody else. And so I'd like to get back to Bob Lauderdale now. When I got old enough to take history courses in high school and do quite a bit of reading on my own, I got a little bit interested in several things, like the Battle of the Alamo and the Chisholm Trail and everything. And I could talk to Uncle Bob, and I went to him and asked him, while he could still remember, about the people he had seen that got their names in history books, such as the Earth Boys and Batmasters and so forth and so on. And he remembered the Masterson brothers. He knew who they were, but he didn't seem too impressed with with any of them. The man he was most impressed, the lawman he was most impressed with, was named Dagger. I don't remember his first name or anything like that, but he said this man was an awesome man. He was well over 6 feet tall and weighed in the vicinity of 270 to 300 pounds. And he seemed to think that the only problem this man had ever had was being able to find a horse that could carry him very far at one time. He didn't seem too impressed with the other lawmen in Dodge that other historians have been impressed with. Lauderdale was an honest man. He didn't brag, and he was never known to be a man that ever drank any strong liquor or anything like that. And he was quite a man in my estimation. And I was glad that I came along at the time that I could remember in person. Now, I'd like to go to one sheriff that we had here in Atascosa County, that he was sheriff, I guess, when I was born. And he remained sheriff until 1943, while I was overseas in World War II. And he was quite a colorful man. This sheriff's name was Dal Makeda. He was not, this man wasn't too tall, but he was an awful well-built man. And he's very agile and able to take care of himself in almost any situation. He didn't seldom ever found it necessary to use his gun. The outstanding thing about him, he could almost enforce the law with most lawbreakers with the toe of his boot. Any person that was guilty of anything less than a felony, he never bothered about putting them in jail. He'd just give them a good sample of what he could do with his boot, kick them around a good bit. After that, well, they knew better than to cross Mr. Dow or Mr. Mike, as he was commonly known. One incident, well, I remember several incidents, but one of the first incidents that I remember was related to me by another fellow that a relative of his was staying with him in Jordan at the jail at the time that this happened. We both being the same age, this happened in 1930, and we both of us was 8 years old. I remember hearing about it, and this fellow can give an eyewitness account of it because he was there. There were six people of Mexican descent came up in a Model T, and there was an open touring car type Model T, and each one of them was armed with a gun of some kind. At least they had one 30-30 rifle. And their purpose of coming to the jail was they come after one of their buddies that the sheriff had in jail. And he was sitting out on in front of the jail in a rocking chair. And they drove up, and the spokesman got out and called him over there. And he said, "Mr. Mike," said, "we've come after a friend that you have in jail, and there's anything you can do about it, because there's six of us, and we're all armed. And we come after him, so you're going to have to let him go, or otherwise we're going to take him." And he slapped this man down, picked him up, kicked him three times, and threw him back in the car. And he was almost too late because the driver already had the car started in motion. And their friend remained in jail, and he didn't have to go arrest them because he didn't figure they'd done anything serious enough to be put in jail for them. They wouldn't try that anymore. That's more or less the way he enforced the law. Of course, the truth about the matter is that some things he was in favor of was against the law. And another time, a Mexican alien was guilty of murder in Lemmy, Texas, which is about 5 miles north of Pleasant. And Mr. Mack followed him and caught the man after he crossed the Rio Grande River. His clothes were still wet where he swam in the river. And he captured him in Mexico. But he didn't allow the Mexican officials. He didn't tell them what he was doing over there and give them any information because he knew that they wouldn't allow him to cross the river with him. And I understand that he got the guilty party back across the river before anybody knew he had been in Mexico unofficially as a law enforcement officer. And he was noted for things like this. I knew the man personally. He, under his, I don't know how to say it, his real rugged nature, he was the type of man that he was a soft man underneath, because he enjoyed talking to children, and he got a lot of fun out of telling kids jokes and things like that. I can remember one time when a classmate of mine and I decided to play hooky one time when we was in the fourth grade. We just walked up to the jail in Jordan and knocked on the door. Mr. Mike came to the door and he asked us what business we had up there. And he said, well, we just came up. We wanted to see what the jail looked like on the inside. And he said, all right, boys. I said, I'll sure tend to that. And he took us upstairs and opened one of the cells and put us in it. Locked the door. And then stood there and laughed. Said, now I guess you boys know what it looked like. And he said, I just want that to be a lesson to you. I don't want you to ever come see the inside of it again. And I guarantee you, I'm 52 years old, I've never seen the inside of it since. Well, Reed, now I believe I'd like to go back a little further and get into something that has been handed down that I remember. Evidently, my mother's people been living in this area, like I mentioned earlier, probably since the 1820s, because sometime in the early 30s, my mother started receiving money from the Mexican government in repayment for the cattle and horses and destruction that Santa Ana's army did when they came through here in 1836. Evidently, there was a claim filed in the early days of Texas independence against the Mexican government or Santa Ana. And later on in the 30s, a relative of mine, an attorney by the name of Wallace Holden, found out about these claims, and in the 30s, the Mexican government started paying all the heirs a small amount of money each year, which was, my mother was one of the heirs. However, no payments had been made since World War II that I know about. Now, I don't want this to be confused with the claims that some other Texans have made when the Mexican bandits about Civil War time came across and drove Texas cattle back across the border, and claims were made, I understand, for this damage. I'm not talking about that. Santa Ana's armies are supposed to have moved through this part of the county, and some historians give the name of this county Atascosa to the fact that that's what Santa Ana men called it, or Atascosa, which means boggy in Spanish. Some historians give credit to the sand dunes, which are in the northern part of the county, or the outcropping of the Carriza Formation, as the geologists call it. They bogged down there, but another legend has it that Santa Ana's army's camp or at least a part of it, camped in the vicinity of what's now Highway 140 and Highway 16. And later, well, this was during the rainy period, and later on they had to cross the Laparita, and they bogged their wagons down between two creeks. The legend has it that some of these wagons contained gold, and the conditions was too wet or too boggy for these wagons to move on, so they buried the coal and then shot all those that knew where it was, except those in charge that did the burying. Now, me being a licensed pilot, I flew the area out and looked where this might take place, Reed. And the only possible place that I could see where this could have happened is on the property that I own now, which you'll probably own part of in the future. You've been my son-in-law. It has to be down there on our ranch, and because Laparita crosses and Goose Creek is about 200 yards north on Highway 16. I think this is the area that they were speaking of, and possibly that a lot of people think, or at least local people think, that that's where the Escobar County got its name from this incident. In the early 30s, first cousin and I, working as cowboys during the dipping days, found a spot which would be east of what's now Highway 16 and north of Highway 140, where evidently one of Santa Ana's armies camped for an extended period of time. It was on a hill, and things we found there, such as parts of old saddles and harness, and the most interesting thing we found was a metal part of a shoe, like the Spanish wore. Now, I'm aware of the fact that Spanish explorers came through this region before Santa Ana's army did, but I think this metal part of this shoe belonged to part of Santa Ana's army, because the outline of the area there where their horses and whatever had tramped the ground so much that you could still see the outline there, which is covered over an acre, the 2 acres, where still the vegetation wouldn't grow like it would in the surrounding areas. We think this is one of the campsites of where Santa Ana had when he came through here. Another thing I think worthy of mention while we're on the subject, Reed, that when I was real young from the ranch house where I lived, every morning when the sun come up, one of the first things I could see off to the east was a place called Black Hill. It's the highest elevation in the county. In those days, in the 20s, built on top of this hill, was the outline of a rock structure, a rock ranch type house. And when I got old enough, I got curious about this place, and I rode a horse over there about 4 miles east of the ranch house. And it was a house that I would estimate from 1,500 to 2,000 square feet in area. The only thing that remained was the rock walls and the doors and windows and 2 cisterns. But the interesting thing about it is the right height all the way around this rock house, ever so often, so many feet, there was a gun port. And where whoever built the house or was there at the time could use their guns to fight off Indians. Now, this is one of the things that I asked Bob Lauderdale about. And he said that the house was built there before his time, that he didn't know who built it or much of the history about it, except that a lot of the old settlers in the 1820s and 1830s had used it as a fortress to fight their way out of the Indians off, and they could come there for safety. He told about times that he knew about that there'd be as many as 50 people there would stay there an extended period of time while the Indians would be on the warpath or whatever they in those days. As I understand it, the Indians didn't uprise too often. Sometimes they had periods of even years would go by and they wouldn't have any trouble with the Indians, and then other times they'd have trouble with the Indians quite often. Even Pleasant today, Pleasant, Texas, you can go in the old part of town and see where the streets, there are no streets that are over a block long. In other words, the streets or blocks are set like a checkerboard. And the reason for this, I'm told by the old timers, that they built it this way. That's the way Pleasant was in the beginning. That so an Indian couldn't ride a horse over a block without having to turn. In other words, this slowed him down, and the people that had to fight him off and have a better chance to shoot either the Indian or the horse, or both. And they couldn't ride through town near as fast. And how this house, why I brought this house out, was after I got older and read history books and things, I found out that they talked about a road that led from San Antonio to Pleasanton through Black Hill to Dogtown, which is now Tilden, on San Diego. Now, and when I was in my teens, this route was clearly defined. I knew it as Old Tilden Road, what we called Old Tilden Road. And you and I have driven out there many times. Part of it's still used there, right where you go from Pleasant out to where we call Five Points. And then the Old Tilden Road takes off there. When I was, say, 14 or 15 years old, you could still travel it, but fences had been built across the road, and you could open the gates and go on if you wanted to travel it, because it hadn't got popular in those days to put locks on gates, and people weren't so anxious to file on anybody for trespassing or anything like that. If you were moving across the country and you came upon anybody, they were usually glad to see you. And if it happened to be mealtime, well, you'd be invited to eat and stay with them. But this Black Hill, the house on Black Hill was destroyed sometime in the 30s. And I've wished many times that it had been left there, because I think this house, if the truth was ever known about it or the history could be found out about it, probably played a bigger part in the early days of Texas history than it's ever got credit for. As I remember it, because just as a young boy, I could see it. That's the first thing I could see when it got daylight in the morning. Reed, you said you'd be interested in what happened, any outstanding experience that happened in World War II. I think I saw several unusual things. First, I'd like to mention I saw my 21st birthday. I was in North Africa, and that was the very first part of it, when we started winning the war in the ETO. In the latter part of 1942. I was overseas for a period of 3 years. And One of the first most outstanding things I ever saw was a B-25. It was flying out of an air base there in Iran, Africa, and they were flying up. This was when they was getting ready to invade Sicily. It was on a bombing mission, and the aircraft got a direct hit with a German 88 in the cockpit, and it killed the co-pilot instantly and wounded the pilot. He was able to get by with it, evidently, because what I'm speaking of, this was back in the days of Prohibition. There was quite a few bootleggers in this area in that day and time, and he more or less went along with them. He figured it wasn't against the law to have liquor and things like that. He always knew in advance if any federal agents was going to come along, and he always saw to it that his friends bootleggers had time to hide any evidence, and therefore none of them ever got caught. I don't say none of them, but no big percentage of them ever got caught because they had protection from the sheriff's office. And I can remember one other incident that happened. I was there personally, and I was just a young boy. They were having a wedding out in the Laparita community. And also after the dance, after the wedding, I had to dance. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, well, a fight developed. And pretty soon, it turned into a gang fight. And one of the people at the wedding got in his Model T and went to town, got Mr. Mike. He just drove up in his Model T. Got out of his car. He didn't bother about wearing a gun or anything like that. And the first one he walked up to that he thought he'd been fighting, he asked him if he had been fighting. And yes, Mr. Mike, I've been fighting. It was even better to lie to him because he'd get treatment with the boot. So he took him over to an oak tree that was in the front yard, threw a trash can around the oak tree, and he handcuffed him to the oak tree. And then he went on to the next one until he got all those that had been participating in the fight, had them all handcuffed around this oak tree. And then he goes on in, tells him he's got everything under control, let's resume with the dance. Well, the fiddlers start fiddling again, and he starts dancing with them. So about daylight, he goes out and asks them if they're all in a sober enough condition, if he'll let them go. Go on back, they'll be smart enough to go home, everything will be all right. Well, that's just an example of more or less the way he enforced the law. But I'm not trying to lead anyone to believe that he wasn't capable of enforcing the law when a bad criminal came along, and he was able to use his gun as well as any other law enforcement officer that ever existed, I imagine. He followed one man all the way to Chicago that was guilty of a crime here in this county, and when he caught him, he was in disguise. This man was in Chicago working in a factory, and he just walked in and tapped him on the shoulder, and the man looked around, he recognized him, and said, "Well, Mr. Mike," said, "you got me. I'm ready to go on back home and face the medicine." One of the pilots in the Admiral of my region, and he was bleeding profusely. The pilot gave the order for the crew to bail out, which they promptly did, with the exception of the flight engineer, who happened to be a very personal, close friend of the pilot. He went up to the cockpit to see what was going on. When he found the pilot in this condition, he refused to bail out. He stayed with the pilot and did what he could to stop the bleeding. The outstanding thing about the story is the fact that when the shell hit the aircraft, it shot away all their controls, with the exception of the tab controls. Now, any pilot understands what tab controls are. The flight engineer stayed aboard the ship and flew the aircraft with the tab controls back to its home base in Africa, and asked for a direct approach, and was able to land the aircraft safely, and got back in time at when the pilot received medical aid, he survived. And I'm sure that if the flight engineer had bailed out, that pilot was, or the aircraft would never have made it back home. Another thing I'd like to include is when I was on the front lines in the Third Army area with General Patton. My mission up there, I was in the medical corps, was to take blood from blood donors, type O positive and also type O negative, to keep a whole supply of blood for the aid station. And one day, while things were pretty quiet, I was up on the front with the weapons carrier, and I heard some excitement, and we observed a German Jeep coming toward our lines, flying a white flag, which was a flag of truce. The truce was observed until the German Jeep got there, and the sergeant with a BAR jumped up in the back, and we asked him what we could do for him, and they said, take me to your medical officer. I heard one of the DIs say, well, there is a blank medic over there. Will you take him down there? And I said, I'd be glad to take him, but you go along with that BAR. I don't trust him when I hadn't been issued a gun. When we got into our American medical officer, he told our medical officer that he needed so much plasma that he had a certain number of German prisoners and also some American prisoners that he needed this plasma for. And he said, you might as well give it to me because you're going to have to take care of them in a few days anyway, the way the war is going. So our American medical officer gave him what he asked for, and I took him back on to his Jeep. And when he got in his Jeep, he looked at me and said, with a British accent, he said, well, cheerio, old chap. Another time, when we were in Epinal, France, General Patton was walking down the street, and I turned a corner too quick in front of him, about half walking, half running, and ran into the old general and knocked him down. All I had time to say was, excuse me, and he jumped back to his feet and said, that's all right, and kept walking. He had with him a first lieutenant and had a BAR on his shoulder, and they were too busy to worry about me knocking him down. I guess I could say I'm the only soldier that ever knocked General Patton down. Came home without any action taken for it. Anyway, it was afterwards, it was kind of a funny incident. Anybody that knew General Patton knows how he talked. He didn't always use proper English. And I'll just throw in one thing that I heard him say here, and I won't use any bad language because I don't know who might listen to this tape in the future. But I think I can get across what General Patton had to say to his men one day. He said something like this. He said, reports coming in that you blanky blank so-and-so have been shooting some of those blanky blank Germans with their hands in the air. He said, shoot those SOBs before they get their hands in the air. That's just the type of man he was. He led his troops with abandon. And I think history will record, and a lot of people that were around at the time will consider General Patton as probably one of our most brilliant military leaders in the history of the entire country. Also, I might throw in this time because I was there. I consider General Rommel, the German general, known as the Desert Fox in North Africa, is probably another one of the great military leaders in World War II. General Rommel, as I understand it, was not a Nazi. And he, what he stood for, he was a good man and an honest man. He was doing his job just like we were doing our job. It just happened that we were on different sides. And if I understand history correctly, he was forced to take his own life rather than to face military trial, which he committed suicide by taking some form of poison. Another thing that impressed me very much was that the war is in. For me, the war was over on the second day of May, 1945. And we were in Germany at the time. We were on attack service and away from my main outfit. We had four enlisted men and one medical officer. Of course, this medical officer, when he was in direct charge of us, we had three vehicles, and we got in radio contact with our commanding officer, Colonel R.P. Mason, which is another officer I have a lot of respect for. And he told us to proceed to Paris. And I don't remember the exact day that we went to Paris. We got there. The French were dancing in the streets and they were really celebrating the war being over. American soldier, he didn't have to ask. All you had to do was tell the French what you wanted. They wouldn't accept money for anything, any food or drink or any kind. If you need a place to sleep, all you have to do is let somebody know. And all soldiers of all any allied forces was, it made us feel pretty much like we were heroes. But a buddy of mine that I went overseas with, we were still together. One day about, I would think, the 15th of May, decided that we'd go down toward Allied headquarters. I wanted to see General Eisenhower, since I'd never seen him face to face. Allied headquarters was in Paris at that time. And we were fortunate in the fact that we met General Eisenhower with another group of officers walking down the street, just made him face to face, and both of us saluted him. And General Eisenhower, evidently, I don't know what happened, but he came up to me and he looked me right straight in the eyes, and I think that he thought he recognized me. And I've never seen but one other man that command as much respect just by looking at you as General Eisenhower could, because it burnt me all the way to the back of my head. And all the General Eisenhower said was, "I'm glad to see you, soldier. Well, good luck." And he saluted me and walked on off. Of course, I saw General Eisenhower on several occasions after this. Another time I remember was on the 30th day of May, 1945, at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. That's right at the head of Champs-Élysées, which is considered the Broadway of Europe. At this spot is the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. On Memorial Day, General Eisenhower went up and decorated the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. At the same time, they had a military band there, and they played the Stars, the national anthem. And as I was listening to them play the national anthem, of course, every soldier stands at attention on that when you're in the service. It dawned on me that I'd never really paid that much attention to it before. What would it have really sounded like if the Germans had won the war? It sounded pretty good to me. Later on, I've heard people complain that before football games, I wish they could dispense with playing the national anthem. I guarantee you one thing, that as long as I live up, I'll have a lot of respect for that song. Reed, I noticed here on this outline that you have number 16 down there, folk proverb. I think one thing worth mentioning here is I also knew Jimmy Rogers personally. I'm speaking of the blue yodeler that they call Jimmy Rogers. And the reason I knew him was he was a fairly young man. He was nationally famous at the time, and he was sick with TB. He had a sister that lived in Pleasant. Her name was Mary Hardy. And her home was located next to the railroad shops where my daddy was foreman of the roundhouse, the night foreman of the roundhouse. Jimmy Rogers came to Pleasant to stay with his sister in the latter days of his life. I've heard my daddy say more than once that when he'd come home in the morning, he'd tell my mother that if I'd get rid of that singer, I'd get more work done. Because all of his men would be over across the tracks at Ms. Harding's house, have Jimmy out in the backyard singing his favorite song. What I knew about him was that once a week, he put on a personal appearance at the old Flash Jacks Theater. Now, this was time when I was 7 or 8 years old. And my mother was good enough to me that she'd take me up there every time that he put on a personal appearance, and I'd sit on the first row and listen to him. I guess that's what got me interested in playing the guitar when I was really young. As you probably know, I started when I was about 10 or 12 years old myself. I felt that really, I realize everybody doesn't appreciate Western, country and Western music, but it's a shame that this man couldn't have went ahead and lived a normal life, because I think he's the one that's kind of started Western music as we know it today. Before that, it was referred to as old-time music or jazz or something of that variety. I'll say this much, that the present day recordings of the man, if you could actually hear him personally, he sounded a lot better than he does on his recordings, because the quality, I don't believe, of the reproduction, they wasn't able to reproduce things like we can today with our modern technology. Reed, the last thing that I'll mention is the fact that I knew a man by the name of Mickey Rosner, or rather I should say Morris Rosner was his proper name. This man was the federal agent in charge of the investigation on the Lindbergh kidnapping. Now, this man I've known since 1952 until his death about 2 years ago. This is the other man that I was referring to when I made the statement a while ago about General Eisenhower that can command so much respect just by looking at you. This man has had an outstanding personality. He was the type of man, all he had to do was just look at you and you'd be ready to do whatever he asked you to do. The reason I know him is I've been working for him in the capacity that he owns some law production here in Atascosa County, and I've been employed either by him or his
widow, who is Ms. Sylvia Rosner, now lives in New York City since 1952. This man is, I feel like, is an outstanding man. He spent a lot of time in Atascosa County because the oil business to him was an adventure, or I might say just a plaything. He's really a wealthy man. He did this type of thing because he liked it. Actually, the man, he was an attorney, and I understand, or at least he told me, that he passed the bar and he had never had any formal education or attended any, had any degrees from any universities. In other words, he simply studied law and had passed the bar in at least the state of New York. And I don't know whether this is entirely accurate or not, but I understand that it is possible if you have the knowledge and you can pass the examination, you can pass the bar. He was a self-styled man, and he was a defense attorney for lots of well-known characters and back in the heydays when they had the gang in Chicago. And then later on, he was chief of police of Chicago. The authorities had designated him as a man to clean up the situation that they had in Chicago at the time. He often laughed about the fact that after he became chief of police at Chicago, the first thing he did was to arrest a federal judge. Now, there's no use for me to go only into detail about this man because I can't give you an accurate description of it, but anybody that ever wants to know the real truth about the man, they wouldn't have any trouble finding him because he has his proper place recorded in history. There's been several books written about him, and I've read quite a bit about him myself since I've been working for him. And I'd like to say at this time, Reed, that I've enjoyed doing whatever I could to contribute. And if anybody ever finds it of any value, I'll tell them in advance that I'd be happy to do it.